Good evening and welcome to the 2005 Alistair Berkeley Memorial Lecture Series. Now, before we start, I'd like to say a few words about this lecture series, which is a biennial event which addresses theoretical and policy issues at the interface of law and development. The lecture series is inspired by the life and work of Alistair Berkeley, a lawyer and an advocate of popular justice for the disadvantaged. Alistair was killed in the terrorist bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, in December 1988. He had studied architecture at Bristol and the Architectural Association. And after a period in Bangladesh, he took a law degree at Cambridge and then went to Uganda to teach. He then returned to the UK and took an LLM here at the LSE. When he was killed, he had just completed his first term as a lecturer in law at the Polytechnical Centre of London, now the University of Westminster. His attitude to life was deeply influenced by the time he spent working in Bangladesh and Uganda, and these experiences led him to a strong commitment to the pursuit of popular justice, particularly for the disadvantaged. Now, in memory of their son's commitment to human rights and justice, Jean and Barry Berkeley have sponsored this biennial lecture series at the LSE, hosted by the Development Studies Institute. Now, past lecturers have included Mr. Olara Otunnu, an Undersecretary General of the United Nations, and Ms. Rosalind Higgins, judge at the International Court of Justice and one-time professor here at the LSE. Today, we're extremely pleased to be able to welcome Dr. Paolo Sergio Pinheiro to deliver the 2005 Alistair Berkeley Memorial Lecture. And I will let my colleague Gareth Jones give you a little bit more introduction to Dr. Pinheiro and his life trajectory.
Well, I won't limit myself. I won't extend to the entire life of our distinguished speaker, but enough to say that we welcome Dr. Pinheiro to the LSE. Dr. Pinheiro is a distinguished academic in his own right as Professor of Political Science at formerly at the University of Sao Paulo and has written very widely, as many of you will know, on politics, but particularly on the limitations of citizenship in Brazil and on human rights, where he set up a center for the study of human rights. His career, if you like, as an advisor to international organizations is both wide and varied. He was, during the 1990s, a rapporteur on the Brazilian Human Rights Plan. He has been a consultant to UNDP. He has been special rapporteur, I think indeed still is special rapporteur, for the situation of human rights in Myanmar. He is a member of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and a special advisor to the International Red Cross. And that is only the top six or seven lines of a CV that runs to about six pages here in front of me. Currently, however, and the reason for inviting Paolo Sergio to the LSE is that he is, and I have to get the wording here precise, independent expert to the Secretary General's study on violence against children, an important report which will be launched in 2007, if I have that correct. We've also invited Professor Caroline Moser, currently at the Brookings Institution, to act as a discussant to Dr. Pinheiro. Caroline has been formerly at the LSE in the Department of Social Policy. Prior to that, she was at the Development Planning Unit at UCL. She's very well known, I think, again, to many of us for her work on gender and more recently on social capital and vulnerability and on violence among youth. She worked, meantime, at the World Bank as well as the overseas Development Institution. So with a very warm welcome, firstly, to Dr. Pinheiro.
Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues and friends, I'd like to thank the Crisis State Research Center of the London School of Economics, and particularly Professor Gareth Jones, and also Olga Jimenez for all her patience following dozens of itineraries before I arrived here, and the Institute for the Study of the Americas for kindly invited me to deliver this prestigious Lester Berkley Memorial Lecture, and for your efforts in organizing this international workshop. This meeting provides an important opportunity for us to reflect upon and evaluate how violence is affecting Latin American democracies today, as well to discuss the implication of this situation for the for the future of the region. Pierre Bourdieu once said that everyday violence is a solvent of human integrity. The levels of violence that are found today in almost every Latin American country, in particular targeting its impoverished youth, constitute a true demonstration of Bourdieu's statement and testify to devastating effect of everyday violence in the continent. About two decades after the fall of many dictatorships in Latin America region, a phenomenon that raised so many hopes and allowed those of us who fought to establish democracy to dream, there is a bitter sense in the air. Campaigns for harsh repressive measures against the poor, disguised as wars against crime, paradoxically find consistent and wide support among the local population. In this context, those who support human rights are confronted with considerable skepticism, to say the least, if not threats and rejection from many sectors of society. It is not very difficult to understand why. Despite some improvements in the juridical sphere, despite the relatively calm and fair electoral process in some countries brought by the democratization processes, an unrule of law continues to be a daily reality to the vast majority of the population. Economic inequality has also increased, and the already fragile welfare state has shrunk to a minimum. Perhaps most disturbingly, the levels of violence in Latin America are among highest in the world, so much so that they sometimes surpass those countries in armed conflict areas. The situation faced by children and youth, especially critical. Data on homicides draw from the 2002 WH World Health Organization report on violence and health, for instance, shows that Latin America youth are the group most targeted for violence in the world. About 29% of homicides in Latin America are among children and youth from 10 to 19 years of age. Available figures indicate that homicide is the second leading cause of death for this age group in 10 of the 21 countries of the region which have populations of over 1 million inhabitants. Youth homicide rates can be up to 3 times higher than national homicide rates. In the periphery of São Paulo, sometimes they are 4 times the homicide rates. In Venezuela, for example, 95% of homicide victims were male, and 54% of them were younger than 25. Media coverage, as well as the issues which feature in the political agenda of countries, also indicate that the involvement of youth in criminal activities and gangs is a particular preoccupation in the countries of the region. In my remarks today, I'd like to explore the reasons for this situation and outline the response that have been implemented and suggest that this violence and those responses are directly linked to the weakness of the democratization process in those countries. The troubling levels of youth violence are also very much present in Central America. In that region, one of the currently most discussed issues concerning public security is the presence of youth gangs known as maras or pandillas, a theme that is very much at the center of this conference. Concerns about maras were amongst the key issues debated during in the last electoral process and led local governments to elaborate ultra-tough anti-gang strategies which attracted international attention, especially from many human rights organizations. The phenomenon of maras or pandillas sheds an important light on the problem of youth violence in democratic Latin America. In particular, as organized and armed gangs expand and allow us to reflect on the common problems found in the state response to these groups. 1 year ago, in March of 2004, during the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights March sessions, I attended a very impressive hearing with several NGOs that work in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, which focus on the Maras situation and the anti-Maras plans in the region. The situation described during the hearing seriously disturbed my fellow commissioners and myself, not only because it revealed the level and breadth of violence faced by Maras members and their victims, but also because it highlighted the very, sometimes only, repressive nature of the state response, which had been marketed as anti-Maras plans and laws. As a consequence of this hearing and other meetings between mid-November and December, jointly with the Inter-American Commission and UNICEF, in my capacity as independent expert appointed by the Secretary General, as John very correctly mentioned, to lead this his study on violence against children. I traveled on mission to El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras to gather information on the situation of Maras, of the anti-Maras plan, and the anti-Maras plans. I presume my function as independent expert is amongst the reasons that I was invited to attend this prestigious conference, particularly as I see many colleagues like Caroline, Donna Di Cesare, Luke, more eminent on the subject of youth violence and social justice in Latin America in here today. I'd like to recall that the Secretary General's study on violence against children result from a request made by the Committee on the Rights of the Child, the expert body which monitors the implementation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the most widely accepted human rights treaty. 192 countries have ratified the Convention on Human Rights, and don't ask me who are these two countries that were not able to ratify. The Committee of the Convention on the Rights of the Child in 2001 called on the UN General Assembly to ask the Secretary General to conduct an in-depth study of all forms of violence against children. Preparations for this study will cover violence against children in all contexts, except in armed conflict, because in the United Nations there is a sort of social division of labor. Mr. Olaro Tunu, that was here giving the same lecture. He's in charge of the involvement of children in armed conflict, and who reports to the Security Council what gives his mandate a very, very high attention. The study aims to provide an in-depth global picture of violence against children and will propose clear recommendations. The study is not an academic report. I don't have anything about academic reports. I will not shoot my own feet. But it's very much a policy-oriented report. And the interlocutors of the Secretary General are the member states. Of course, the civil society also are among these interlocutors. But formally, the states that have ratified the convention are very much responsible for the implementation of the convention. Violence against children in conflict with the law, which I'm addressing today, is one of the most obvious and relevant core topics of the study. It's not easy to discuss the tough and complex realities which adolescents and youth face in Central America. Before my mission, I was, of course, aware of violence in that region through the commentaries of many of the authors and researchers in this room. But it is one thing to have some information, to read reports, to know the statistics, and another to meet with all the players in the tragedy. Marineros, their families, the police, the human rights activists, the judges, and the authorities, including President Maduro of Honduras, one of the initiators of the hard hand, mano dura approach. I was honored that President Maduro graciously received me and my team for 1 hour and a half for a present, it's a lot, and engaged with us in a candid and helpful discussion. I will not say frank, because this in the UN means that it was really a bad conversation. But it was a candid and helpful discussion. Although I was fully aware of his role, let's say, muy comprometido in the huntings of the Marineros. The president himself have a waistcoat and go use it to go with the police to collect the Marineros. After seeing those countries, as well in my own country, Brazil, the degrading and devastating effects of violence inflicted against stigmatized populations, it is difficult to talk about the poor and the oppressed in an accurate and realistic way without appearing either to crush them as perpetrators or to exalt them for their resistance and resilience. I'm aware that scholars conclude that the inclination of violence that is endangered by early and constant exposure to violence and is one of the most tragic effects of the condition of poor communities through Latin America and the Caribbean. The Maras, as other youth gangs, have several common characteristics. They are formed through the common experience of their members and as such form a community, and they change their behavior and objectives in accordance with the context to which they are exposed. The emergence of the first Maras occurred perhaps more than two decades ago, around 1992. But the transformation of those groups into a key public security issue is a more recent development. According to existing research and information gathered during our visits, the Maras are formed mostly by young people with between 16 and 25 years old. They establish and implement clear codes of loyalty and conduct. The majority of them display external symbols such as tattoos that you can see in the photos of Donna de Cesare in the ground floor, exhibit specific body language and wear distinctive clothing, thereby establishing clear territories of control and rivalries among different gangs. The number of Mara members and the real impact of Maras in public security are motives for many creative and absolutely unreliable governmental data. Indeed, in some instances, during our mission, taking the elevator from one floor to the other, the figures we were quoted that the same ministry changed by 200%. Just changing the flaws. I'm aware that definition of gang membership is something that has plagued gang research since this phenomenon has begun to be studied, and the very concept of gang is frequently. This can be very convenient for those who wish to use the term in a discriminatory way. I will not go on this discussion of definition because this was addressed earlier in this workshop. Our discussion with adolescents during our visits clearly demonstrated that some factors are common to the life histories of Mara's members, pointing to some root causes for their engagement in these sorts of groups. Without intending to establish any causality between poverty and the Maras, is necessary to remind that the majority of group members came from the poorest sectors of the population, had no access to a proper education, have been abandoned or expelled from local schools. One tragic reality in Latin America is that violence is often directed by the disposed against their companions in misfortune. Youth gangs often use violence to meet their economic and social and economic needs, further adding to already high levels of violence in their community. For example, in my own country, the absolute majority of homicides in São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro are committed amongst the working class. Very few of my white and elite compatriots are murdered, and even less are the object, of course, of state violence. It's not fashionable to torture my class under a democratic regime. This is no accident. The violence exerted every day in families, factories, workshops, banks, offices, police stations, prisons, is in the last analysis an effect of the inherent violence of economic structures, income concentration, structural racism, which is manifested sooner or later in the form of crime and delinquency, drug addiction, alcoholism, involvement in criminal gangs, a whole host of minor and major everyday acts of violence. Policies of economic stabilization, aggravating the situation of the majority of families and their children, are assiduously implemented by government, including those described as leftists, immediately they take power. The multiple marginalities that affected Mareiros are certainly aggravated by global processes like economic restructuring and democratic transitions after war and regional peace process. Frequently, during my conversation with Mareiros, I heard the background echo of violence as a reproduction of violent patterns internalized during the Civil War. One of the dynamics that works in the Maras system, una cultura callejera, that seeks to fill the vacuum left by lack of education, non or underemployment, and lack of social investment has emerged. In this context, the Maras, in a certain way, are a reconstruction of those elements that were lost and that cannot be recovered. But this reconstruction, and particularly the attempt on the part of adolescents to replicate past roles, constitute a terrible burden for these young people, which at the same time has required enormous inventive capacities. The growth of the number of gangs has coincided with its access to small arms. The years of regional conflict has facilitated the spread of small arms in the region, identified by the World Health Report as a key factor leading to the escalation of lethal violence in Latin American region. In Brazil, for example, homicides among youths increased by 77% during the past 10 years, most because violence has involved firearms. The Central America response to the Maras issue have had an important and negative impact, and at the same time are extremely revealing about the Latin American repressive tendency vis-a-vis youth violence. As mentioned during the most recent electoral process, public security has been one of the top issues in campaigns. In El Salvador and Honduras, laws and reforms of the penal code created specific penal measures for those who were considered to be Mara members or committing the crime of illicit association. The legal reforms introduced in respect of the Maras contradicted, of course, the existing national, regional, and international standards and guidelines, including the prosecution of the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The concrete results of these measures were also appalling. During our mission, we received frequent allegations of abusive and sometimes arbitrary detention of hundreds of suspected Maras members, with the result that detention were rapidly filled and became increasingly violent. In Honduras, for example, two of the major riots between the end of 2003 and beginning of 2004 resulted in 1,500 casualties. The approach introduced in the context of the Maras reflected a very sharp rhetoric. In El Salvador, the first version was called mano dura, and the second, super mano dura, heavy hand and super heavy hand. Anti-Maras squads were created, mixing police and army, one of Latin America's favorite approach under dictatorship and under democracies. And you would even see reference to what is describing as the beginning of Mara hunting season. Some of those hunts including the present Maduro as the convoy leader, despite his elegance during our conversation. Expressions found frequently in the first pages of newspapers reproduce the linkage between Maras and the vast majority of crimes on a daily basis. This phenomenon were not an unfortunate exclusivity of Central America. Public frustration with crime, fear of the recent rise in youth violence in all continents, and the racial characteristics of violent young offenders fuel the desire to get tough and provide the political impetus to prosecute large number of young as adults. In similar scenarios in the region and outside, the media and the members of the political establishment publicize exaggerated claims of danger posed by unconventional youths. The fragile implementation of the reforms of the juvenile justice system also exhibited daily contradictions. Despite some good efforts, the new never replaces the old in the region. Discuss of protection, restoration, punishment, responsibility, rehabilitation, welfare, retribution, diversion, human rights continue to exist alongside each other in some perpetually uneasy and tremendously contradictory manner. Sentences clouded in layers of rhetoric on the best interests of the child are spoken alongside the practice of incarceration of youth, condemning the young to possible abuse, torture, and sexual assault for their alleged education and training. The juvenile offenders justice system, as implemented in many countries in Latin America, reproduce the same problems that you may find in the adult penal system. These include slow response to cases and the extremely high number of non-processed detainees and a chaotic situation within detention centers for offenders that you can visit in any country in South America. In this context, one perceives that the juvenile justice system is as bad as one designed to adults, but is weaker in providing detention measures. Therefore, it's not very surprising to see also very high popular support for ideas directed at reducing the age of criminal responsibility or to create exceptions that would allow children to be tried as adults, as proposed in Mano Dura plans. As I mentioned in the opening, the tragic linkage between the limited democratization process and the rise of violence in the region has deep consequences in the way democracy is perceived today and may help us to understand the current scenario. The Latin American region has undergone a democratization process with important achievements restricted mostly to the institutional level. A recent UNDP report on the region notes that at present established electoral mechanisms exist throughout the region and that it is moving towards a juridical and institutional adaptation to the principal international human rights standards. But at the same time, this progress has not been replicated in the social and economic situation of the population. The entire region is marked by remarkable social and economic inequality. That is clear the case in the three countries I visit. In Honduras, for example, 79% of the population is considered to live in poverty. In El Salvador, the underground market is considered to employ 42% of the local workforce. In Guatemala, access to the educational system is very difficult for the rural population. Only 24 of the schools are in the rural areas. As mentioned, despite democracy, the rule of law, particularly for the majority of poor Latin American children and adolescents, rights continues to be elusive. The region is still struggling with seemingly intractable problems: abusive use of lethal force by the police force, extrajudicial killings, lynching, torture, abominable prison conditions, very well described by report of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, corruption in the criminal justice system that persists. These phenomena continue to occur despite the numerous attempts to eradicate them by legislative reforms and institutional building. As I said, the Convention of the Rights of the Child has ratified by all the states of the American continent, except the two that I indicated. Also, civil society has been encouraged to organize and has extraordinarily expanded. Though at first all measures flourish, we see that within a few years, each one of the measures and policies adopted seems to lose efficacy and credibility. Those forces within the state apparatus and the political arena that resist change seem to prevail. This trend is precisely the opposite of what is forecasted by democratic transition theories. It was expected that as a democratic political system developed, there would be clear reduction in human rights violations. Among those human rights violations, neither is more pervasive than the violence against children and adolescents perpetrated or condoned by democratic government. This unfortunate dynamic is helping to create a perverse linkage between the adoption of modern international human rights standards and the growing violence. This situation provides important insights into how widely and deeply the democratization process has become entrenched. Unfortunately, the anti-Maras measures with their repressive rhetoric are hardly promising this context and may even worsen the situation to the extent that they appear to ignore the root causes of the phenomenon. How can we prevent conventional youth and teen groups becoming violent? How can we make violent communities become safer and stable? How can we break the violence, the cycle of violence, and reintegrate back into society those that decided to engage in illicit activities? These are not easy questions. As everyone is aware, there is no easy and fast solution. No prêt-à-porter plans that can be developed and replicated everywhere disregarding context specificities. We are working with problems that have deep connections with communities and their recent stories. We must repeat as a mantra that prevention is possible. I believe that we have already some knowledge about what may work and what generally doesn't work well. Easy access to small arms, the recurrent and banalized use of institutionalization measures are clear warning signs. Well-structured public culture and leisure facilities and schools integrated well with their communities are essential. One evident problem that will be faced by every government is that the fact that appropriate measures will require time to promote durable and sustained impact. And of course, the timing of elections for the politicians is not very good combination for this timing. In this aspect, I must say that almost as the repressive hype is alarming, the fragmented and sometimes very superficial preventive response that are already in place in the region may produce even more adverse effects. Even in El Salvador, after the mano dura, they tried to attenuate things with a mano extendida, extended hand, which is until now just a gesture of good intentions. And of course, is the First Lady of Honduras that's in charge of the mano extendida. Since the spreading of the preventive mantras, many fragmented programs were developed in Latin America. Although I acknowledge the great importance of mobilizing and empowering communities, of promoting human rights education, I believe that if those programs are not accompanied by consistent improvement in the state apparatus, without this and a radical change in the functioning of the public security and judicial system, those efforts will not be successful and may even increase frustration and skepticism of democracy. It's not by accident that the Latino barometer in the last 5 years indicates that the favor of the democracy is declining. Brazil, for instance, is very much under the average percentage of those that prefer democracy to an authoritarian regime. It is imperative that security and judicial system be rendered not only more efficient, but more credible, accessible, and accountable. An improved level of safety and conflict resolution requires both systems to be credible and accessible to the marginalized population. That requires then the most, and that is normally distant from a fearful of the state security and justice systems. All repressive policies must be conceived with total respect to human rights standards. It is also crucial to develop a more reliable data bank on security issues. The absence of information renders effective responses by states more difficult, and any form of evaluation impossible. It is particularly important to ensure that all the measures taken are viewed not only as security issues, but also as human rights issues. Even if we are speaking about specific preventive measures, we are dealing with basic rights that have to be respected for the full development of human beings. Today, more than ever, it's clear that democracy and human rights are inseparable. For democracy to prosper, human rights must be implemented. Citizens must feel protected, not only from arbitrary behavior by powerful groups in society, right to physical integrity, but also must share in the wealth that is generated in the society. Democracy demands the participation of children and adolescents in their recognition as full citizens and not as mini human beings with mini human rights. Not only the children in the continent are being treated as mini citizens. All this youth that is treated like prospective criminals, they are considered without rights. They are no citizens. Access to economic, social, and cultural rights are being increasingly interpreted as key elements for the exercise of the children and youth rights, since if children lack access to health and education and of secure livelihood, they cannot enjoy in the future their civil and political rights. Democracy and the protection of the human rights, and among them children's rights and youth rights, are works in progress at national and international level. The repressive measures criminalizing the younger generation in Central America that was born during the beginning of the redemocratization processes in Latin America is surely not inspiring at all, and we must exercise our best efforts to ensure that they will be dismantled. Thank you.
I'd like to say that how delighted I am to have this opportunity to respond very briefly to Paulo Sergio Pinheiro. And I want to give particular thanks to Dennis Rogers, not only because he's been very unwell, but also he's coped very much with the vicissitudes of my own movements and whether I could or couldn't come. I want to really compliment some of the comments that have been made. I think that we've had a very important focus on the relationship between violence and democracy, and the weaknessing of democratic processes, and a particular emphasis on the Maras and the Mara issue in Central America, and a focus at the macro. I'm going to do a little bit different and try and complement that by starting at a micro level and identifying a couple of issues around local community perceptions and experience of violence, and in this way stress some of the broader development policy implications. As Dennis said earlier in the introduction, it's the links between development and legal structures that is our focus here, and I hope that this contributes a bit. I've been researching aspects of violence since about 1992, when, as an anthropologist living in a slum community in Guayaquil, Ecuador, the local community said that their lives were becoming more violent. And I've since then worked in Colombia, Guatemala, and Jamaica. And I want to apologize that my comments are going to be very anecdotal rather than conceptual or analytical or statistical. I literally returned last week from 5 weeks working again doing anthropological field work back in the same community. And so I'm afraid I'm still in that community rather than in this world, as it were. This is the last stage of a 25-year research process in which I've documented the consolidation of an urban slum and looked at the intergenerational transfer of assets in the community. And we're talking about the change from a marginal squatter settlement in the 1970s with no services, no infrastructure, but very little youth violence, very little street gangs, and very little child violence at all. What we're talking about now is a consolidated, lower-income, well-serviced neighborhood, many of which are the homes of second-generation families with kids who have completed high school education. So this is a success story. It's a community that's done very well. But along with the better services, the better education, and the jobs have come increasing inequality, devastating, and a devastating acceleration in levels of daily violence. On the Calle Ka, the K Street where I live, 2 months ago, Willie, what's called a sano kid, in other words, he's sane. It's a Spanish term. He's a university student. Killed another kid. Killed Chucky, who was the leader of a rival gang, after repeated taunts and Russian roulette-type threats. In the subsequent retribution, Willie's mother, a local school teacher, secretary of the community committee, together with her immediate and extended family, were forced to flee for their lives as their houses were torched in retribution by the gangs. This happened like 5 houses from where I was living. In the 2-block stretch of about 100 households today in this community, there's something like 15 known robbers, armed young men who line up to rob women as they get off the local bus laden with their Saturday shopping. 3 young men are currently serving prison sentences for robbery. One of the biggest drug distribution leaders resides 6 houses from where I was. A minimum of 15 known small shops sell drugs, mainly cocaine pasta, along with other household items. An unaccountable number of young teenagers cycle around selling or distributing further drugs at a dollar a go, folded into homemade school paper envelopes. Police cars cruise past with such frequency that they're not even noticed. Payoffs of robbers picked up and put down at the end of the street are part of everyday life. And on top of this, there is the domestic violence that affects a large number of households, though there are important intergenerational changes in this. So this is not yet a Rio-type slum. It's not a slum that is run by drug lords, but the fear and the impotence of local barrio leaders to deal with the gun-related violence and drugs confronting them suggests that somehow this community is somewhere in the middle of a continuum from where they were before and where they may end up in another 10, 15 years. This is the reality I've been living in, and it's made me very pragmatic about a number of issues. First of all, obviously, the figures I gave you are not all youths, but a large number of them are within the 12 to 24 age, if we're talking about youth. The point I want to make is that in this community, not all young people are victims of violence, and neither are all of them perpetrators of violence. What we see here is that different types of youth violence are identified, calling for different types of solutions. In addition, community perceptions of justice may differ from those of the state or other institutions. In the eyes of the community, Willie, the leader of the Sano gang of kids seeking education, seeking better opportunities, struggling through first years of university with state university without resources, he's the victim. He's the victim who was taunted and harassed to the point where he got a gun and after a steady night's drinking, he shot the perpetrator, Chucky, a known leader of a drug dealing gang. So we have a difference of perception in communities about justice in itself. Therefore, while it is important to separate categories of youth when dealing with issues of violence, it is also important not to decontextualize them from as social actors in terms of the contexts in which they are living, in terms of their own identity and their own agency. Thinking about this and thinking about this sort of reminded me a little bit of the early work on women and development debates, where women were identified as victims, and the shift to viewing them as social actors in the gender and development debates that provided far greater scope to understand issues of causality, the power structures that so frequently resulted in subordination. And I ask myself, do some of these same issues of power and power relations help us in understanding some of the issues of youth violence? First of all, the need to disaggregate youth violence into its different manifestations. The MARAs are absolutely critical. They are an important and very, very frightening phenomenon that we've been hearing about. But they're not what all youth gangs are about in South America. Secondly, identifying complex issues of causality. The difference between poverty and inequality being a very obvious one. The importance of structural as against individual causality. And thirdly, separating myth from reality in order to better understand the social construction of gangs, for instance. A few years ago, we did some work for DFID where we tried to deconstruct 7 prevailing gangs, myths about gangs in Central America. And we argued that in Honduras, where you have 40,000 gang members, was it useful to identify them as a social movement constituted essentially of disaffected, excluded youth asserting their social identity through violent acts? A different way of looking at an issue from the one that is currently the case. Given the wide scale and ever-growing hype that undoubtedly the media hype around this issue, it is absolutely critical, but it is not the only type of issue. You'll hear a lot, we've been hearing a lot about different types of interventions. So I want to end by just making one comment, which is to focus less on what the interventions are, but focus more on the reasons for intervening. In the same way that we now have a second generation of slum dwellers in many Latin American cities, I argue we need a second generation of policies to address their concerns. Poverty reduction policies focused almost exclusively on what I've decided to call first generation strategies, the provision of water, the roads, the electricity, the housing plots, the better health, the better education. Once these are provided, it is assumed that development occurs. But when these do not bring the expected returns, when education does not bring the expected job opportunities, that's where we get rising aspirations, growing despair, and increasing violence. So we need to really think very strategically around second-generation development strategies that need to address the range of issues that are essential if the capital assets built in communities are not to be eroded, and the sorts of goals that get counted in the Millennium Development Goals simply evaporate. So what I'm talking about is relating to the mainstreaming of an institutionalization of a range of issues that are currently seen either as palliatives or citizen security issues or human rights. In other words, recognizing that the important reason for undertaking and addressing issues of violence obviously relate to rights, obviously relate to social protection, but maybe also fundamentally relate to the whole issue of development itself.
Thank you very much, Caroline. That was a very excellent sort of launch pad, shall we say, into questions from the floor. There are a couple of roving microphones. If you could perhaps state who you are and then give us your question in English, please, and be as brief as possible.
My name's Irene Halford. I'm a security student from Southampton. And my question is in relation to Venezuela. It is the capital of violence at the moment. Why isn't there any studies being carried out by the main institutions as the OAS, UNDP, and so on, especially in relation to youth and children?
As far as I know, from the hearings in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, there are a lot of studies on violence in Venezuela. I'm not an expert on Venezuela, but there are very active NGOs, and I think that we have a good picture of the situation of violence in Venezuela. In a certain way, Venezuela shares the same characteristics of the one of the main causes of mortality of the youth between 19 and 25. You don't have exactly the same maras, because let's not think that all the continent is invaded by maras. Sometimes you have the impression. Caroline was mentioned that it's very important to taking consideration the context, but I'm aware that there are a lot of studies on Venezuela. Is it? You just try Google. You'll find an enormous amount of research on Venezuela. I'll be able to share with you several references. Okay, that would be a pleasure.
David Maidment, Children's Rights Advisor to Amnesty International UK and co-chair of the Consortium for Street Children. Have you found in your investigations any good practices which have addressed community violence and gangs? I'm aware that there was some research done, I think, in South Africa around Durban, in looking at gang prevention or tackling some of the issues in the community, which was, to my understanding, successful. And I don't know to what extent good practice is in fact being fed to you and useful.
As I said, I'm not an expert on youth gangs. I just benefit from my investigation in Central America to accept this invitation. Of course, they are good practice. What is great in South Africa is the involvement of community. There are several initiatives in terms of not to dealing with the macro, but try to involve communities in rehabilitation. Is a term that I don't like very much, but alternatives to repression, a repressive approach. Even in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. For instance, Guatemala, where the human rights activists are in power now, they are doing their best in terms of change. That is the question of suppression and intervention and rehabilitation. They are trying to contain the repressive approach. To be fair, even in Honduras, it is when you have this initiative of the Mano Estendida, is that they are having some problems with the only, because of course, as I told you, this approach is suicidal in terms, because the population is not seeing any benefit in terms of public security. Then the study of the Secretary General will not be a catalog of horrors. We like very much to be positive and to find best practices. I'm aware that even in the most hostile environments, you have people introducing innovation and good practice.
Can I just compliment and say that I think that I agree totally with my colleague. Two things that I think are important. One is a lot of the practice is piecemeal. And secondly, there has been very little evaluation. And that is really one of the biggest problems. I mean, Salvador itself is a sort of testing bed of different types of solutions. And I think one of the big challenges in terms of research and further work is evaluation of the outcomes of these types of measures. And the fact that many of them are very small scale, and it's the scaling up of them and moving from these piecemeal types of initiatives that is going to be so critical.
Let me give a footnote about that. For instance, Guatemala, they are doing their best to change, but for instance, one of the propositions was to establish a farm to, instead of sending the youth to the jail, to send to this farm. Then I was not getting very much. It's all this myth that you're working with the earth or in a farm, you'll be rehabilitated. It's a myth that accompanies all the history of the prison. And then they, in all good faith, then with a lot of psychologists and social workers but they are intending to put somewhat 5,000 youth. And I was trying very humbly to tell them that perhaps it would be very complicated to have 5,000 youth that with very sophisticated and very complex approach to their lives to put all these people in one firm.
And only because you brought up Venezuela, I can tell you that a very well-known businessman in Venezuela is doing exactly the same, sticking a whole lot of kids on a farm. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that needs to be looked at much more robustly and evaluated.
No, because this is very much linked to the vices and to the scene that you have in the urban scenery, and then they will have a recovery in the rural atmosphere.
There's a question
right in the middle.
Leo Thomas, DFID. I want to ask Dr. Paolo, he seemed to be suggesting that there was a dynamic going on between the increase in adoption of rights mechanisms at the national level and yet a paradoxical extension or regression in terms of human rights practice on the part of government. I want him to just elaborate on that a bit.
Thank you very much. It's a very important question. This is the paradox of democratization in Latin America. That is all this opposition that was built on the protection of human rights. When they arrive in power, they forget human rights because they are not able to reform the state apparatus, for instance, in a rights-based approach, because they are so much moved to give quick answers to the increased number of crimes of homicide that you renounce to all this the principles, the generous principles that illuminated the fight against the dictatorship. For instance, one of that is the very something that's very recent, the association of Maras and terrorists. That is that great country in the north is very much responsible for that, because they are seriously, and I have very serious conversations in Honduras and El Salvador, where I was inflicted a PowerPoint that is the worst thing that has been invented in the earth for lectures, and then for PowerPoint demonstrating that some Maras were connected to terrorists, and then the introduction of some terrorist legislation to deal with the Maras. I think there is a, that is, of course, that is a cliche. Since the 11th September, you have 9/11. Since 9/11, you have a regression in terms, as Irene Khan once said, human rights are in the back seat. But in Latin America, they are in the back seat much before 9/11. Because, why? Because the democratic governments are not able to introduce reforms that will help the implementation of human rights principles. I will just mention my own country, where that is, most of the governments after the transition, they try to do some innovation, but they are so much dependent of the support of the right and the coalitions. That is, all the left governments in Brazil, they are hostage to the right. Then you don't reform the institution. The police killings in Brazil last year is the peak of all the years since the 70s. You have one person killed every hour in São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro. That is, and this is a very democratic, progressive moment. I think there is a schizophrenia in terms, and what suffers is democracy. Take a look in the Latino barometer. The survey is a proof that a high percentage of people will be able to support authoritarian regimes if they have this option. It's good to.
There's a question middle back there.
Yep. I'm Angelica, and I'm a student at the Institute for the Studies of the Americas. And I was just thinking, do you think that the Cuban system is a model for Latin America to follow with regards to the treatment of children? The Cuban model?
A model?
Or the Cuban system is a system that the Latin America...
I don't think that that is a model. I think that... this model has a lot of problems if you have a human rights perspective. I think that I will commit suicide in Brazil if I imagine that any of the presidents will stay for more than 40 years. I have a problem with that. It's even under dictatorship, it was rated every 4 years. The generals were changing. But I can't imagine. I think that the idea of... alternate governments are a very healthy thing. Then I don't think that the Cuban model has not this rotation of presidents, for instance. And of course, you don't have any of the basic freedoms that we are fighting against our military dictatorship. Having said this, of course, it's outrageous. Policy of the United States in terms of and of the Inter-American system of discriminating Cuba. I think this is anachronism that Cuba continues to be outside the UAS. But of course, this is Cuba is not a model. I think that we have to be very respectful and try to accompany what will be the transition and to be very sober and serene vis-a-vis Cuba and wait.
Mayela from the ISS in The Hague, student in The Hague.
And my question, you elaborated in your address on these countries, these hundreds of countries who have signed the CRC and other international conventions, and you also mentioned the infractions that a lot of these countries have committed by changing their youth penal codes and passing new legislature altogether. I wonder if you can elaborate a little bit on these international conventions themselves and whether perhaps the whole issue of rights as rhetoric versus rights that are realized, and whether these conventions are able to transform rights as rhetoric into rights realized. And I think this issue really highlights the need for those conventions to be able to do that more than rhetoric.
The first thing that we must acknowledge is that the victims, they like the convention. It's very important. It was the convention of torture was decisive in terms of the fight against torture. Ask Amnesty or Human Rights Watch. Then a convention is not a magic wanton that suddenly change the situation of human rights. But it's very important as a reference for civil society, and also for civil society to ask, to pressure countries to comply. That is, when you have a certain skepticism, what for this government, they ratify conventions, they don't pay attention. But there is a process. They are obliged to submit reports to the several treaty bodies that accompany the conventions. I think that the example of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, I think that has immensely helped the fight, the struggle for the protection of the rights of the child. We are in a very delicate moment. As you know, the Secretary General has proposed a reform of the Commission on Human Rights, and proposing a Council of States, and also the functioning of the treaty bodies are being revised, because it takes so much time to analyze the report. But I try to play the game of asking what was the discussion of human rights 10 years ago, 20, 30 years ago. That is, the Commission on Human Rights between 48 and 70 was just writing and preparing standards and convention. In 1975, it was appointed the first mechanism to monitor human rights in the world, that was the Special Rapporteur on Pinochet dictatorship. Everything is very recent. That is, in my age, half of my age, 30 years, is very recent. And then I think that without the conventions, the very powerful international human rights organizations were not able to work, or also the civil society organizations in each country. I'm very enthusiastic. That is, I think that is not very helpful to work very much on skepticism vis-a-vis the convention. And the law also. The same thing. I was in Bamako yesterday, in the Central and West Africa, and the mantra that was being repeated: what for legislation? What is the use of doing laws? It's the same reasoning towards the vis-à-vis the conventions. Of course, the law, the legislation, is not a magic wand, but is a tool to fight, to promote, to conquer rights. Then I think that's very important to have a very dynamic approach, and not just to see the convention and to compare that the developments or the progress is very small. I think this. And my basic test is the victims, they adore the special rapporteurs. They think that the conventions are great to protect. That is, the political prisoners that are being tortured, they are so happy when the committee of the Convention on Torture visit them. I think only this is a great help.
Okay, if we get a sort of queuing order here, there's a question right in the middle. Then we get to the lady down at the back here, back up to the top, and Paola, and then to the front here. Okay, and then we'll have a second round.
Hi, my name is Mohyum from the University of Liverpool. I have a question which is perhaps quite odd at a conference on youth violence, but it's specifically about the attention given to the problem of youth violence. I think one of the things that has come across from this afternoon's discussion and from what you were saying was the lack of data on how much violence and crime can actually be attributed to youth groups, whether they be MARAs or whether they be kind of disorganised groups of youth. And I'm wondering, does this kind of, for want of a better word, inordinate attention given to the problem of youth take away important resources, which would seem to be the case from my research in El Salvador, from other forms of very pervasive violence? What springs to mind immediately is the case of the murders of women in Guatemala City this year. There's been over 500 women killed, and this is not mentioned in international, in any of the kind of international discourse on the problems of violence in Latin America. So it's kind of, do you think that the tension that is currently being given to youth violence actually is kind of comparable with the scale of the problem?
I think Caroline will say something about this. She knows everything about that. I'll just say something. It's not by accident that you don't have data. Why you don't have? Not because the Latin American governments are unable or they are not competent. Because they don't want to play transparency. Why they would reveal the exact nature of the situation? For instance, there will be a very clear demonstration that most of the MARAs are not murderers. In Brazil, when you speak about the youth or the even children, there is an armada of children killing people. And then when you go, it's a very small, a very tiny percentage. I think that's very good for governments and for politicians because you don't have transparency, then you can have all these inventions that every season of elections that you have blood in the mouths of the candidates so that they need the votes. Then I think and I hope that one of the recommendations of the Secretary General study is the absence of data. You have surveys in the Northwest, you have a lot of information, but of course that in the South you have a lot of problems. But the good things are happening. I was in Beijing 10 days ago, and very good survey on stories of youth about experiencing violence at home. Then we know in 9 provinces of China what is the situation. But I think that Caroline would say something more confident.
Well, no, I mean, I think that you're making a very important point and one that one could elaborate more in terms of other types of violence. For instance, we did work in Honduras. We ran a workshop with Maduro there as well, where we flagged the issue of institutional violence, which, of course, nobody's discussed at all, which is much more, which is drugs, prostitution, car rackets, all the migrants now, migrants, the selling of migrants, these are types of incredibly important institutional violence, which it's politically not expedient to even raise as an issue. And I think the issue, just as the issue of gender is a sort of weak, soft, let's keep inside the household issue, the issues of institutional violence are so politically sensitive that people don't want to raise them. And I think that the MARAs, particularly in Central America, have become a scapegoat so that to not look at these other forms of violence. And therefore, one's plea is that they are seen in a balanced way relative to other types of violence. And the fact that a large number of them are not violent. Going back to your question about good practice, I remember years ago meeting priests in Honduras who were setting up centres to take away tattoos, because that was the first thing that these kids wanted, in order, because of the association of having a tattoo, meaning you were Mara, meaning you were killing. One of the first demands from many of these young men was to get rid of the tattoo. So that I think there is a terrific exaggeration, and that's not to say that they're not a problem, and it's allowed other forms of violence to be obscured.
Perhaps that is not to invite despair. It's very important that in the 3 countries that I visit, there are public prosecutors doing a formidable job. You have ombudsman. It would be very inaccurate to think that these societies are completely under this institutional violence. Inside the state, you have sectors that are trying to do something positive, so in the NGOs, but also inside democracy. The democratic miracle was this, that inside the state that was always repressive and authoritarian vis-a-vis the poor and the Afro-Latinos, you see inside the state, careers of the state that are trying to work in a rights-based approach that denounce authoritarianism and this repressive policy, so that we can will have a more accurate a picture of the situation.
Hi, my name's Emma Grant. I work for the British agencies in Colombia. I wanted to pick up on something Caroline said about community perceptions of justice not always being what, any of the panelists would necessarily agree with, and what the implications of that fact is for promoting participatory forms of policy making at a local level or community models of justice in the absence of adequate state policy or apparatus.
For me?
No, well, it was for you, Caroline, really.
I was so calm here because I expecting that you...
No, I made that point, so the answer comes from you. It's about communities often having different perceptions of what's justice than outside actors having relating to killings, which was my example from where I came.
Can I clarify? It means that if gang members want to set fire to other gang members' houses as a form of retaliation, when you then try and promote participatory forms of policy making at a local level, which go beyond just tokenism, surely you're going to also end up with a conclusion which is, well, local violence is a way of dealing with violence.
I think that states and governments have a huge responsibility in the existence of lynching, for instance, lynching in Brazil. São Paulo, that is the first word, is one of the champions of lynching in Brazil. That is very paradoxical. But the responsibility is by the state. I think that's very convenient that sometimes these communities have some alternative models for justice. Not what the South African approach in terms of working with the community and trying to see alternative ways of dealing with policing. But I'm saying that justiceros, vigilante, lynchings, the democratic state survives with all this. That it's acceptable that 20 years after the return to democracy, we have lynchings in Brazil. Something that's no more fashionable in the States. And the last lynching, qualified lynching in the States was in 1952. Then in 2005, we have in many countries of Latin America, we continue having lynching. But I don't think that I answer your question. Caroline,
it's a really interesting question, and I think in my own, just thinking of it really empirically and when I was there, I think the problem is that there is no trust in the state and in the state's ability to hand out justice in a fair manner. Because obviously this Willie killed this other guy, and everybody knows that. And I think if they felt that this guy was going to have a fair hearing about the type of extraordinary harassment and treatment and, you know, Russian roulette guns and things that went on before, he would get a sentence that actually was relative to what he had occurred. What happens is that doesn't exist at all. So there's no trust in the state system. So it's not that the community itself should solve the issue. I don't think they should. But their perception of how to solve it is also a reflection of their lack of trust in the police and their lack of trust in the judicial system within which they're living. I think that's sort of what I would come out with at the end.
Okay, we're going to take a cluster of questions from Andrew.
Hello, Professor. I'm Hidden here. We have already spoken today. First of all, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm from the Embassy of Brazil.
I'm a government official. I think I'm a rare species here today. And I come from the same university as Professor Paulo Sérgio Pinheiro, and I'm very proud that he's here today, not only as a government official, but as a Brazilian, because he's an example for all of us that studied human rights at university. He's a professor, he was part of the government, he now works for the UN, so, well, he's an achiever for all of us and an example. I hope that we have others that will follow the same path. And my question is, you mentioned that sometimes governments are forgetful of what they, when they were in the opposition or when they were fighting for democratization, they sometimes forget their ideas on human rights because they have to deal with very urgent issues, such as violence and security. And we had examples in Brazil of governors, for example, that were good, but were criticized because they were said to be incompetent dealing with violence, meaning they were not really hard on thieves and so on. And having been part of our government and having a very realistic view about what is possible, what would be your suggestions to those governments in terms of what can really be done? Because conventions are not magical ones, and also policies that we try to implement will not be effective tomorrow. So what would be your suggestions? Thank you very much.
Bring the microphone to Andrew at the front here.
Hi.
Yeah. Then to Paola down here after.
I'm Andrew Fisher from the Destin here at LSC. And both speakers, you both put emphasis on sort of increasing inequality and, for instance, the disaffection that comes from economic exclusion, essentially. In particular, I appreciated Carolyn Moser's comment on the emphasizing the structural aspects of inequality rather than the individual aspects of poverty. But I was wondering, underlying all of this, these comments is an emphasis on economics, essentially. And in particular, there's this whole escalation of violence seems to correspond quite a bit with the whole economic collapse of Latin America, of course, like the lost decade of the 80s, which people don't refer to much anymore, and the application of the neoliberal economic model on Latin America with, you know, deregulation, privatization, and liberalization, and the types of inequality that's been generating. And I'm just wondering, how much can we discuss these issues of violence, social justice, even the contradiction between the legalistic democratization versus the social abuse of human rights? How much can we discuss all of these issues with really considering the larger political economy issues, both at the international level and the national level, for instance, class issues and things like that?
My name is Paula. I'm from the University of São Paulo as well. You were saying that violence in Latin America, it's attached in a way to our weak democracies. However, we can say that in the past 10 years at least, institutions, of course, they are far from perfect, but they are stronger. I mean, we can talk about the judiciary or even the military police regarding homicides, for example. They are no longer judged within the corporation. Civil society is much more organized. So I think that institutions are strong, democratic institutions are stronger now. But on the other hand, we had violence has increased over the past 20 years. So how do you combine these two scenarios?
I'm Sandra Jovcelovic. I'm a social psychologist here at the LSC. My question is for both speakers. In a way, your talks describe what I think it's a bit of a divide in the way we approach this problem. On the one hand, you have institutional responses, you have the articulation of international agencies, governments, the level of legal response. And on the other hand, you have the experience of communities on the ground where a lot of people are trying to understand
the perspective of actors, as it were, how people are coping with violence, are living with violence, are responding to violence. From where you both are sitting, how do you see the possibility of a dialogue between these two dimensions? Do you think that there is potential for states and international agencies to incorporate, to listen to, and to develop a relationship with the experience that is being developed in the ground? And on the other hand, can people who are living in the middle of violence and developing responses that might seem odd, irrational, or utterly incompatible with our conceptions about what is a good life, can they engage in return with what is expected in the world of law? How do you see that dilemma?
Okay, I will try to comment very briefly on the two questions of Angelica and Paula about what has happened in Brazil. I'm not very good at advising governments, but I think the basic suggestion is that presidents and ministers are not supposed to make compromise because of electoral needs. I think that we'll have progress, and I think this is valid for any country, because of course governments have many issues and many questions to give answers. But you cannot renounce to be. I'm remembering a wonderful person called Emilio Mignone, a very brave fighter against dictators in Argentina. He said once, "We have to be principistas. We have to be principle oriented. That is, that even if the president is not every time speaking about human rights." Some sectors of the government must be independent and principistas in terms of tackling the violations that occur in Brazil. For instance, last year we had more killings in the rural conflict than in the last 10 years. The reform of the judiciary, that I think is a positive thing, took 13 years to happen, and something that Fiona and other team was around here fighting for the federal competence of crimes. Happily, this has happened in the reform of the judiciary. The federal competence to investigate and to deal and to try human rights violations defined by human rights institutions. But this has not been yet regulated. The military police, yes, the military police, I think it was 5 years, it was in Cardoso, first Monday, we were able to transfer the competence of the civilian courts to judge military police, but just for homicide. And something that we forget in Brazil, that the investigation of every crime committed by the military police continues to be done by a military investigation bodies that sometimes is one amateur investigator of the military police. Then the government is very. I'm not just mentioned the present administration, but this is valid also for the previous administration that I have some linking. Government to postpone changes in this area because of the need of constitutional reform or to maintain the support of the coalition in government. The Cardoso administration and the present administration, they have the same coalition supported by the right and the extreme right in Brazil. But nobody in Brazil is right, because it's not elegant. And then you don't have, you have always center and center right. Then the most extreme center right that you can have. This doesn't function, because you have to make concessions every day. Then the same picture that I was trying to give to Central America, of course I would give to Brazil. For instance, if you take the role of the federal prosecutors, this was a revolution in terms of authoritarianism in Brazil. The problem is everything is very slow, and the victims are really despair. And I don't think that any government was able to really advance in terms of dealing with this violation. Of course, the Cardoso administration was more at ease with the human rights drama that this government doesn't. It's not very very enthusiastic in expressing. But there, I'm not praising one and saying that this one is worse. They are both in the same contradiction, that you have wonderful leaders, leftist, progressive, that are dependent on the right. In terms of these issues of human rights, that is the Brazilian main contradiction. There was, I liked the, I don't remember very much the last question, but I liked very much the word that you used, dialogue, conversation, negotiation. The problem is that the democratic states, they don't dialogue with the communities. They are not, that is, of course they have these populist meetings on that, but they don't listen. They are not interested in the voices of the oppressed. Of course they want the votes of the oppressed, but not the voices. And I think that it would be essential, but Caroline knows much more than I about community. I don't know anything about that. I think that is decisive for the improvement of our democracy to hear the youth, but also the of course, Paula was saying there was an immense progress in terms of civil society organization in all Latin America. In Brazil, it's amazing. When we were preparing Fiona the Human Rights National Plan, it was extremely moving that you go to Maceió and you find gay rights association. It's very difficult to be gay in the Northeast. Gay rights association, women's association, indigenous association. That was, for me, that I don't know very much all the Brazil, that was very, very moving. Then I think that the interlocutor is ready, but the governments usually are not very interested in listening their voices. What do you think, Caroline?
Very, very quickly. I'll try and get the other two questions more. I think, you know, one of the things we have to start by remembering is that in global terms, Latin America is not poor, right?
And Brazil is is the 11th or 15th industrial power in the world.
So if we're talking development and development policy, we're not talking Latin America. And what that means is that, why is it that this subcontinent that is seemingly less poor than a lot of the others has this very high level of violence? I think it raises very, for me, very important issues, not just about poverty, but about the issue that somebody said, which is the issue of inequality. What I find fascinating was that if you look at development policy, it's about let's get the human capital right, let's get the health right, let's get the education right. That creates the opportunities, and then everybody will take off. And what I was trying to say in my very short, which is just some preliminary thoughts coming back from the field, was that we need a second generation of strategies that recognizes that getting that right isn't going to solve a lot of what are actually development issues. And that what you find, I mean, in the community where I work, the average father had under primary school education, the average son has completed secondary education, and he can't get a job. And so what are the tactics? He goes to Spain. One in three households in my same street has got somebody abroad. That's the safety net. Get out, right? What happens when that safety net doesn't exist? We haven't talked about remittances. We haven't talked about kids who've got out. We haven't talked about the implications of that on family structure, et cetera, et cetera. If you don't get out, you hang in if you have stable, supportive infrastructures and extended households that keep things going, or you go for the quick bucks and you steal and you get involved in these alternative types of things that we're talking about. So I come more and more to think that in the second generational issue, we really do have to understand much more about what are the causes and consequences of this type of inequality, and that they do relate to global processes, I think, in many contexts, and I think they're exaggerated by global processes. But again, they're context specific. I think you answered very, very, very appropriately on the issue of dialogue. What my own experience is that politicians only go to the new communities because they want the new votes.
Yeah.
So that
every
they,
4 years.
So that they go to the communities who have not given their votes. And so they don't go back and dialogue with the communities that are consolidating, that have been there longer, because there are no new votes there. And so there's no dialogue in those communities. And when there is dialogue, it is of a very limited sort for a very specific gain.
Garrett, let me give a paranoid footnote. What you'll see is the following. To mention what Caroline mentioned about violence in Latin America, I don't think that is an accident that you have this violence. I think that this violence is very much functional for the kind of domination that is reproduced in Latin America. That is, this doesn't affect the game, the circuits of power of the elite, because the homicides in Brazil, of course, sometimes you have a professor of the University of São Paulo that is murdered, but this is very rare. In my neighborhood, what is the rate of homicides? 3 per 100,000 population. If I go to the periphery of São Paulo, among the ages of 19 and 25, you have 190 homicides. Then we are surviving. That is how you this incredible city, the wonderful city of Rio, that today is completely surrounded by organized crime. But this organized crime was not parachuted in the hills of Rio. Every governor, every mayor of Rio was seeing this domination of territories. Luke knows this better than I. This all the engagement of the youth and the children in this organized crime. I think that we have to understand violence so that will not make the victims guilty. You have to tackle the question of corruption. That is how the executive power in many countries is funded by organized crime. That is impossible. I was involved in Rio in 1944. And then it's when I returned to Rio, in the very lavish houses of my relatives in the hills, because since the 18th century was better to live in the hills because it was more fresh. Now these beautiful houses are completely surrounded by the gangs, and you are having dinner very elegantly with butlers, with waiters, and then you have arm shots around, and you have to be aware to leave the veranda because you'll be very much exposed. But this was not an accident. This was built with the tolerance of the state and of the society and of the white elite.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to call a halt there because, and perhaps quite fortunately, there is a reception in the atrium. Wine, two waiters, no gunfire. at least, I can't guarantee, but it would be unlikely. Thank you very much, fellow Sergio, for a most enlightening talk, a most wonderful Alistair Barclay Memorial Lecture, and thank you very much to Caroline Mosley.